and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the deep state. And every single president not honoring whistleblowers or those who are uncovering crimes against humanity and breaking the law, but rather punishing those who uncover it, allowing those who commit crimes to go free. At the CIA, the National Security Agency, the FBI, Homeland Security, why is it? Why are they doing this? My guest today to explain all this is a person who spent a lot of time in that environment. He is John Kiriakou. And John, by the way, is a former CIA analyst, a counterterrorism operations officer, case office and senior investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was later John Kerry's intelligence advisor. And after 9/11, John was chief of counterterrorist operations in Pakistan, later becoming the executive assistant to the CIA's deputy director of operations. Later, he turned whistleblower over the CIA's torture policy practiced against prisoners in custody, many of whom died. And he became the first government official to confirm the use of waterboarding on al-Qaeda inmates. He was tried for passing on classified information that included the name of a fellow CIA official to a reporter and served 2 years in federal correctional facility for it. The sixth indicted whistleblower by Obama under the Espionage Act. By the way, Obama, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, but committed Americans to more foreign wars and regime changes than any president in American history, and the person who then found whistleblowers to be susceptible to the Espionage Act, he brought more people in and indicted them than all other American presidents combined. Nevertheless, in spite of his being put in prison, John has received, before he was put in prison, 10 exceptional awards from the CIA and the State Department's Meritorious Honor Award. He's received the Joe Calloway Award for Civic Courage as a national security whistleblower. In 2013, the Peacemaker of the Year Award from the Justice Center. 2016, the John Adams Award, among others. So, yeah, it was expensive for him. He lost his life savings. He had to file bankruptcy. He lost his marriage. And the media, including the liberal media, really attacked him. He authored several books, including his most recent, Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. His website is John Kiriakou, and that is KIRIAKOU.com. And before we go to John, just one other thought here. Right now, we're being told that the Russians were responsible for Donald Trump's election. This is an absurdity. You can hold Donald Trump, as I do, at the lowest metrics as a person and certainly as a president. But once you say that it was a bunch of redneck undesirables that elected him, then you put a lot of people in a position of feeling, as bad as my life is, of all the promises made by Clintons in the 90s and George Bush and then Obama, and not once did you honor your word. You didn't bring jobs back. You told us after NAFTA that it was good for us. It wasn't. And we've been living in abject poverty. So we figured, since you betrayed us, maybe this guy will raise enough hell that he might get something done. I don't know of a person that voted for Trump because they liked him or thought he was a smart guy or a moral guy. Everyone knows how failed he is as a human being, but they can't stand the system because the entire system failed them. We're in a substantial cognitive disconnect on this. But what's going to happen, however, is the important issues that impact hundreds of millions of people in the United States and others around the world are not being addressed. We're not doing anything to change climate change, the causes of poverty, people's debt, people's health problems, helping a person with the disease so they don't go bankrupt. The things that matter, bringing jobs back, we're not doing any of the above. Instead, we're playing this blame game, and it's foolish, and it's childish. Let's go over to my guest now. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
John, at the crux of this is a choice of conscience that not every public employee makes when they see wrongdoing. You saw what you believed was not just inappropriate or unethical behavior, but illegal behavior, something that we should not accept. You then brought that to the public's attention. So for uncovering a crime, many crimes, as it would turn out, against humanity in torturing, you became the prisoner. You became then the point of focus of both Democrats and Republicans, conservative and liberals. Hillary Clinton attacked you, and others attacked you as well, including Obama.
Yes.
Isn't it just rather ironic, and did you ever think in those moments when you were going through this very challenging time in your life, I'm being punished, ridiculed, destroyed, including your family reputation, because of doing the right thing, and these people who are my accusers are not taking any responsibility for the wrong things that I uncovered. The forum is yours. Take us on this journey that you have been on.
To answer your question quickly, yes, I felt abandoned, frankly. I felt like every American should have and probably would have done what I did, because we're supposed to be a country of laws. We're supposed to be a country that's governed by a constitution, and we're either going to observe those laws or we're not. But let's not pretend to be something that we're not. So I was extremely disappointed at the Obama administration's decision to prosecute me. I really believed then, and I continue to believe now, that I didn't do anything illegal. And I chalk it up to Barack Obama telling the American people that he was going to be the most transparent president in history and then turning out to be the enemy of transparency. It was a terrible disappointment to me. I believed in hope and change. I volunteered on the campaign in 2008, and then it ended up that in many ways Barack Obama was worse than George W. Bush. So I was very disappointed, but my attorneys and I decided that we were going to fight, that I hadn't done anything wrong, and we fought as long as we could. So what the government does, it's a strategy they use called charge stacking, where they will charge you with multiple felonies, regardless of whether or not you've actually committed these felonies. And then they wait until you go bankrupt. And once you do go bankrupt, they come back and offer you a choice, that they'll dismiss all the charges but one if you take a guilty plea. Well, that's why the government wins 98.2% of their cases, according to ProPublica, because who would want to roll those dice, knowing that you have only a 1.8% chance of success? And like I say, it becomes an economic decision. I had five children at home, and I was looking at 45 years in prison, and they're offering me 23 months, so you take the 23 months. And that's what happened. And that wasn't just me. That's pretty much anybody involved in national security whistleblowing. Another shame of the whole situation is that while we have a whistleblower protection law in this country, national security whistleblowers, CIA, NSA, FBI, et cetera, are exempt from its coverage. And so if you see waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, and you report it, even if you report it to the oversight committees, you really take your life in your hands.
What was your biggest disappointment as far as the people who should have come forward and didn't, who could have caused some impact upon the public perception and possibly the judicial outcome if they would have said, do not bring him up on all these charges, he's going bankrupt, he did not do wrong? Who would you have hoped would have been there who was not?
Well, that's another easy one, but I'm going to preface it by telling you that that a group of 77 former CIA officers wrote a letter to President Obama asking him to pardon me. My congressman, James Moran, gave a speech on the floor of the House asking the president to pardon me. The man who wrote the law that I was convicted of violating wrote a letter to the president saying that I should never have been charged in the first place, that that's not why they wrote the law. And then I actually found an op-ed written by Joe Biden in 1981 saying that the law that I was convicted of violating was unconstitutional on its face and should never have been passed. So a few days before I left for prison, I wrote an email to John Kerry. By then, he had become Secretary of State, and I sent it to his personal, private email. And I said, Mr. Secretary, please weigh in with the president for me just to commute my sentence. I'm not even asking for a pardon. But if he commutes my sentence, the conviction still stands, but I can stay home with my family and work and put food on the table. And 2 days later, he answered me. But all he said was, please do not ever attempt to contact me again. That was my biggest disappointment.
Wow. And this was the selection for the people who didn't want Ralph Nader, because if Ralph Nader had been elected president, we wouldn't have had a CIA out of control, a National
That's
Security
right.
Agency out of control. Here's what the dumb, I'm not going to denigrate them with what I really feel about their stupidity and their lack of moral ethics. But when everybody was yelling at me for voting and promoting Ralph Nader twice, Jill Stein in the last election, Rocky Anderson before that, I said, just take a look at the underlying principles. Who controls the legislative process? Not just directly, the person in front of you who wants your vote, but behind them. Where have they received their income, their money?
That's
where they're going to vote. And yet everyone says, no, 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 he is liberal. It doesn't matter what title you put on something, moniker it with anything. Where's their ethics? Because we wouldn't have had 9/11 happen. We wouldn't have 900 military bases. Do you ever think about if only we would have been smarter than the choices of our group leaders?
I have completely come around to that point of view. Ralph Nader has been very good to me, very generous with me. That Joe A. Calloway Award was given to me by the Nader family. And it was Ralph and Bruce Fein, who's one of the country's greatest constitutional scholars, who wrote to the Wall Street Journal on the day that I left for prison saying what a travesty of justice this was, that the torturers have gone free, the people who conceived of the torture were free, the people who implemented the torture were free, the attorneys who wrote specious legal arguments endorsing the torture were free, and the person who blew the whistle on the torture was going to prison. So, yeah, you are exactly right. Ralph Nader, Rocky Anderson, Jill Stein, I would even throw Gary Johnson in there. We're missing out as a country. If we're going to talk about politics, you know what? Maybe we should talk about politics. I've come to the conclusion that there really is no difference between the two major parties. We live in this duopoly where they just trade power back and forth. Sure, you can see some differences around the edges, maybe. But when it comes right down to it, they're both corporate-controlled parties. And there's really no difference in their underlying policies. If we're going to take our country back, we have to have a viable third party, and we just don't.
Point well made. I'm going to give a larger, overarching estimate what I believe is happening, and then I'd like for you to take any part of it and share your input, all right? I've been an investigative journalist my entire career. Ralph and I used to write back in the late 60s, early 70s for Caveat Emptor, Consumer Beware, which at that time was our leading whistleblower expose publication. And throughout all that time, what I saw was any time you mentioned that there was a powerful cabal of individuals working towards some common interest, you'd be considered a conspiracy theorist, even though I published over 400 major investigative reports and 58 cover stories, all factual. Mm-hmm. Not once has the people in power, like the major editors of the New York Times or Washington Post or commentators on network television, acknowledge that, yes, there are groups of people who are more often than not behind the scenes, who have the power to influence both domestic and foreign policy. One good example would be the Council on Foreign Relations, which was David Rockefeller's brainchild.
Yeah.
And they have 5,000 members, and those people really form policy. Then the think tanks and the so-called experts, these think tanks, these technocrats, these best and brightest, they go forward and are the public voice and consciousness. John Bolton is one of those. Now, here's what happened, in my opinion, subjective as it is, when it came to Trump. I find no redeeming value in Trump, either as a human being or in his position as this a faux politician. But with all that I oppose Trump on, there is one thing that he did that no other person since Henry Jackson back in the 40s was able to do. He got the deep state players to actually show themselves. And instead of looking at what this opportunity with this door slightly open and the American journalists going in there and reporting on this, they have looked in the opposite direction. They've opened every other irrelevant door leading nowhere. But here you have the CIA, the National Security Agency, the FBI, the Justice Department, the White House. You have all the top players behind the scenes, mm-hmm. all working to get him out of office. And if they preventing from getting in office or get him out of office, so that once again, Hillary or whoever they're going to assign would be in that position of power. They're terrified of losing power because they don't know what he will do. And everyone else, had Clinton been elected, you wouldn't have had an expose about anything. There'd be no problems with oversight of Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, big pharma, big ag, all those major industries that we have found have not been working on the best interests of the American public. Not a single expose or anything would have come out to expose him. But now that this has happened, they're exposing themselves. And I believe if this momentum continues, and depending upon what the Justice Department's Inspector General comes up with, there could be grand juries bringing these people in under oath this time and looking to see where the crimes were committed and could unravel a substantial amount of what's been going on for decades. Your thoughts?
I have to agree. And I'm glad that you use the term deep state. It's funny to me that now it's those who purport to be on the left who claim that there is no such thing as a deep state, that it's a right-wing rallying call. That's just simply not true. Of course there's a deep state. You don't have to call it the deep state. You can call it the federal bureaucracy. You can call it the state if you want. But the truth of the matter is we have hundreds, perhaps thousands of people in the senior intelligence service, in the senior law enforcement service, at the CIA, NSA, FBI, DIA, NSC. They've been there for years, in some cases decades. They're unelected, and they essentially run the day-to-day operations of the government. Now, they know that they can outweigh this president, just like they can outweigh and have outweighed any other president. They didn't like Bill Clinton. They knew Bill Clinton was going to leave eventually, and he did. They didn't like Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter lost in 1980. They knew he was going to. And that's what they do. If they don't like you, they discredit you, and then they just wait you out. And this is dangerous to democracy. How do we counter this? The only way we can in the system that we have set up for ourselves is through robust oversight. But we don't have robust oversight. We have oversight committees on Capitol Hill that act as little more than cheerleaders for the intelligence community, not as overseers. So we need real reform. We need Frank Church and Otis Pike. We need somebody like them who has the guts to take on these entrenched interests in Langley and downtown in Washington and up at Fort Meade. And we just don't have anybody with that kind of courage on Capitol Hill.
For 33 years, I had a daily radio program on WPFW in Washington, D.C., 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And one time, I was doing a lecture as a fundraiser for the station. And after the lecture, this gentleman came over to me, and he said, "Could I have a moment of your time?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I work for the CIA. A lot of people do." He said, "I've been down here a long time." He said, "Twice in your lecture tonight, you referred to people in power working with other people in power to remain in power." And he said, "That's the entire gist of this whole system." And we spent about 45 minutes, and he was explaining to me how it's done today and the how the deals are made and how the legislative aides, the two important senators and House members, how they will make deals to get legislation passed where no one does anything over the computer. They don't want that leaked out or over the telephone. Instead, they'll go in the morning and play racquetball and talk out their deals. In return, at the time when this legislative aide decides to pull it in, he will be guaranteed anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000 salary, plus an American Express black credit card with no limit. He'll be able to share different corporate retreats and have access to places around the world he would never, ever go on his own, couldn't afford to. And this is the payback. Now, how many people? And so I asked him, how many people are involved in this? He said, north of 300,000 people who are the permanent technocrats, bureaucrats in Washington, a lot of what are called stay-behinds, political appointees. He said, it doesn't matter. Don't look at them as Democrat or Republican, left or right. That is irrelevant down here. We don't care about that. We care about people staying in power and nobody embarrassing someone. And he said, there's too much money riding on it. And so I took that home and I went back up on the train that night and I just couldn't get that conversation out of my head. Now you were in the nest. You were high up, higher than most people ever in their career are going to be in an intelligence agency. You had access to people, contacts, information. Would you say that that is a fairly accurate or inaccurate summation of what really goes on, this whole group of people working together, even though they're in different industries, different parts of the government, but they're all that part of the cohesive hive of that gigantic corporatization of the public interest in Washington, D.C.?
I would absolutely agree with that. When I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I was the senior investigator. So my job was different from all the other jobs on the committee. Well, when John Kerry decided that he wanted to sponsor a bill to allow for carbon tax credits, even though we were the Foreign Relations Committee and this was the purview of the Finance Committee, he assigned everybody on Foreign Relations to help finance come up with this bill. And so there was a veritable parade of lobbyists that came into the office every single day. Again, I was just an observer. I wasn't really involved, but I had a front row seat to all this. They came in every single day with language for this new bill, not just the bill, but amendments to the bill. So the staff members on Capitol Hill never actually wrote any of the bill, the carbon offset bill. It was all done by lobbyists. And then when it was all over, and the bill was defeated on the floor of the Senate, almost everybody on the Foreign Relations Committee went to work for those lobbyists, for exactly those enormous salaries that you mentioned a moment ago. And that's the nature of this revolving door government we have. It's corrupt by its nature. It's built to be corrupt. It's built to make people rich. Look at the CIA. Let's look at the past leadership of the CIA, the likes of George Tenet, for example, or Jim Pavitt, or Mike Morrell. I mean, these guys all go on to corporate board seats, multi-million dollar salaries at investment banks, at vulture capital banks. They go on to riches beyond their wildest dreams. And that's not what public service is about. That's a corruption of public service.
I never interview, John, I never interview people on the show who are politicians. It's rare. Unless they're doing something that shows they have the courage to stand up, even if they lose, I'd rather respect someone who loses with integrity than wins with dishonesty. So I had Ron Paul on because I felt that he was doing the right thing on certain issues. Also, when it came to the presidential campaigns, I wrote out 30 yes or no's. Gary Johnson, Rocky Anderson was on, Jill Stein was on. And let me explain a few of these and then explain why we are in a cognitive disconnect as a society. I ask him simple things. I won't go through all 30. Would you reverse or make an effort, national effort, to reverse Citizens United? They all said yes. Would you demilitarize the 900-plus bases around the world that are causing economic instability because of how much they use, but also social instability in countries that don't like our presence? Yes, they would. Would you legalize drugs? Yes. Would you give pardons to those who've been put into prison for using drugs so that they could start their life over, expunge the record? Yes. Would you take all of the money out of politics and have a lottery system so people were able to get elected based upon their principles they were offering, not who was behind their campaign? Yes. Would you close down poverty prisons and private prisons that are leeching off this whole, if you're poor, you're a criminal? Yes. would you stop the adulteration of our soil, water, and air by polluters and go back to Ralph Nader's 168 principles more than any elected politician in history? As a non-politician, he caused more laws to be enacted that protected us, and many of these are being reversed. They said yes. And so those are just some of the ones. Would you reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act? They said yes. The Commodity Future Trading Act, yes. Would you get rid of casino capitalism's derivatives and credit default swaps? Yes. And this is the most important thing. Would you bring in a group of non-politically aligned constitutional scholars and jurists to bring those individuals in government who broke laws that were considered crimes against humanity so they'd be brought to justice? Every one of them said yes. Now, imagine if any of those people had been elected, what the world would be like, going back to what we mentioned earlier. And now look at the pathetic excuses of politicians, what they stand for today. Your thoughts?
Oh, so true. So true. And, you know, one of the mysteries to me of our political system is why more Americans don't see this for what it is. Why do we think that so many Americans aren't smart enough to be able to choose a third party? It's something that's very disappointing to me. You know, I actually spent some time with both Jill Stein and Gary Johnson in 2016. I actually traveled to a lot of states with both of them. And they were serious political figures. They were serious in their positions. They drew large crowds. And then people would say, well, they don't really have a chance at winning. I guess I'm going to have to vote for the lesser of two evils. Well, the lesser of two evils is still evil. It's up to us to stand up and say that we're not going to accept evil anymore. We're going to stand up for someone that we believe in. Someone who believes in what we believe in. Someone who's going to change our political culture and get us back to where we should have been in the first place. You know, starting with Citizens United, it's completely corrupted the entire political system. There's no justification for Citizens United. Money has ruined our political system. And it's made a permanently entrenched, like I said earlier, duopoly that is a disservice to the American people.
In your many years working with the intelligence agency, I'm sure that you either heard about or became aware of, in part or whole, problems that the CIA had gotten itself into. But I'm concerned that these agencies, which are still run by human beings making decisions, are never held accountable for the crimes that they commit and haven't ever been. Going clear back to the FBI's always had a culture of corruption, and the OSS, McDonovan's group, and the FBI out of Hoover, it's always been this way. Your thoughts?
Oh, it always has been this way. I mean, Hoover sort of set the standard, didn't he? We should be ashamed of a lot of what our intelligence services and the FBI do. They essentially answer to no one. And as you said, no one ever pays for crimes that are committed. That was something that I stood up for. Again, the rule of law is very important to me. That's what ought to make us special as a country. But when the rule of law is implied, or not implied, but when the rule of law is applied only to a certain segment of society, that's un-American. It's not fair. It's just plain wrong. Let's look at torture again. Nobody was ever called to account for torture. Now, I understand if the Justice Department tells rank-and-file CIA officers that it's okay, it's legal to torture prisoners. I disagree with it, but I understand why people would do it. What I don't understand is what happened to those officers who killed people in custody. Because they did. A lot of people were killed in custody. Well, that's not legal. That's not what the Justice Department said you could do. So why were those people never brought to justice or held to account? That's the corruption of the system. And it's not going to change at all, again, because we have only cowards who serve on these Senate and House Intelligence Committees. As another example, the nomination and confirmation of Gina Haspel as the CIA director, I was very outspoken in my opposition to Gina Haspel. I wrote a long op-ed for the Washington Post, received 2.8 million hits, and I thought I had made an impact. I got a call from Rand Paul asking if I could go up to his office and strategize about how we can block Gina Haspel. I really believed we had a chance to win. But then the moral cowards in the Senate Intelligence Committee showed their true colors. People like Mark Warner, who professes to be progressive, voted yes. And Gene Shaheen, another progressive or self-described progressive from New Hampshire, voted yes. Well, if the progressives are going to reward a torturer, someone who is instrumental in carrying out the torture program, then we don't have a chance. We can't win anything up there.
It went a little deeper than that. She was not only, we're talking about Gina, Gina was not only responsible for torture, she was also directly responsible for communicating with the person who destroyed all the tapes.
That's
in
right.
Spite of the fact that she was fully aware that the head of the CIA, the director of the CIA, and the president's national security advisor both said do not destroy the tapes, and yet she went ahead as chief of staff under him.
That's right.
She knew that what he was doing was breaking the law, and she went ahead and subordinated that to do so. And nothing happened to him. Nothing happened to her except she was promoted up to director of the CIA. You can only imagine now what will not happen with any reform in the CIA because she is a part of it.
You're right. I'll tell you, the only thing that happened to him, you're talking about Jose Rodriguez, is that he ended up getting a $6 million book advance for his memoirs. That's the only thing that happened to him. And then Gina Haspel. I mean, I said this in the Post. The example that the CIA has set with the elevation of Gina Haspel is that you can commit war crimes, you can commit crimes against humanity, and you can still get promoted. Indeed, you can be promoted to director. So why follow the laws if you know that you can break them and get away with it? See, it's the nature of the CIA to constantly push the envelope, to constantly push at the bounds of legality until someone on Capitol Hill says, wait a minute, you can't do that. That's what oversight is supposed to be, but we just don't have it.
When you look currently at what is happening with domestic policies, given Donald Trump's willingness to strengthen the police state and surveillance of the nation and arrest those who oppose and write against him or charge him with treason, etc. And then you look at asset forfeiture.
Yes.
But where people are not arrested, not even given a ticket or a fine, their assets are simply taken. By the way, just not cash in a car, frequently their car and even their home or business, this has also happened to, yet no one is doing a thing about it. When we have drone operators, in fact, one was on this program last week, who said that he personally was responsible for killing 18 civilians. Nothing happens to him.
No.
And no one else involved in that whole system. And the stupidity of him not being able to determine if a person is an enemy combatant or not, so they simply say anyone over this age is considered an enemy combatant. How would you know the exact age of someone? You wouldn't.
No.
And how? And so is it a matter of kill as many people as you need to get the one that you think is important and then have no moral equivocation in the whole process? But people still know when something is wrong. And that's why we have such a high degree of post-traumatic stress disorder in drone operators and others, just like we did in Vietnam, where people were dropping napalm on people they didn't see up close, but later would realize when they saw photographs of people and the burned to death, I'm responsible for that. So take a look for a moment at the whole idea that we are rewarding a culture that does not hold true to any international or even domestic laws of conduct.
So right. I spoke with a drone operator about a year ago, a former drone operator, and he said that he had been court-martialed because he was at a drone facility in Nevada. His boss was at MacDill Air Base in Florida, and they were both looking at the same screen. And so the drone is flying over a village, and they see some people on the ground, and the supervisor at MacDill tells him to lock in and fire. And the drone operator says, I can't fire. There's a child there. The supervisor said, that's not a child. It's a goat. And he said, it's not a goat. I'm telling you it's a child. And he was ordered to fire. And he refused to fire. And he said to me, it was clearly a child. And I couldn't just kill this child because my boss is telling me to. So he didn't fire. And he was court-martialed and thrown out of the military because he wouldn't kill a child. That's what we've come to in this culture of ours, this military, militaristic culture. I'm not sure how we turn back from this, especially when we have this parade of leaders who glorify war. You know, let me tell you an interesting statistic. In George W. Bush's last month as president, he killed two people with the use of a drone. In Barack Obama's last month of president, as president, he killed 424 people with drones. I mean, that's the pattern. That's the trajectory. It's not something to be proud of. It's something we should be ashamed of.
But we've overly identified with identity politics, so if a person is saying that we should trust them and they say it in a calm and even tone, or an erudite tone, we tend to give them a pass.
That's right.
George Bush could not articulate. Donald Trump cannot articulate. But Bill Clinton was extremely charming. And do you see him being vilified by the Me Too movement?
Never.
And yet he engaged in more acts against women, unwanted and provoked, including rape, and not a single comment of making him held accountable. That is the hypocrisy of our existing system. And that's why I have nothing to do with identity politics. It is corrupt to the core, and people refuse to see it. So that's why I said earlier, put it in perspective. Pull back far enough from this, John, and you'll see the following. The average person cannot give you the name of a younger person, cannot give you the name of a book they've read. They cannot give you the name of a book. They even were mentioning names like The Lion King. One of the people said, no, that's a movie. We're talking about a book. The average person only reads one book the rest of their life after they graduate from college, nonfiction book. We have people who have no sense of history, no sense of geography, economics, philosophy of life, ethics. We have the world's largest percentage of obese and diabetic children, adult diabetes in children, of any nation in the world per population, meaning more than the 1.3 billion in China and nearly 1.4 billion in India. They're about side by side. Yet we have more per population. We have more junk food going into people's body, and as a result, diabetes, obesity. 45% of all adults in the United States are overweight or obese, the most in our history. We have more people in debt than ever before. The average American, over 125 million Americans, do not have $500 in savings, and they're living credit card bill to credit card bill, kiting credit card bills. We have a country that puts all of its attention on the benefits of power and none upon the benefits of humanity and moral action. We talk about being for peace, democracy in the world, and freedom, and then we invade seven countries and destroy their economies, destroy their population, over 1.4 million people dead in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we destroy the Paris of Africa, 54 countries in Africa. Libya was the wealthiest, highest percentage of educated people, higher than the United States or Great Britain or Germany. How about that? No one ever talks about that. Free education and no crime. And you could walk down the streets anytime, day or night. More freedom for women than any other Islamic state was in Libya. In fact, it was a part of their government. You could not discriminate against a woman. You could not insult a woman. You could not verbally assault a woman or physically assault. And yet Gaddafi, we called him the person running, the dictator. He didn't run. There were 10,000 constitutional forums in Libya, so that you got the local people made up their own rules. Every barrel of oil went into the public's personal accounts. There was zero debt, and yet he wanted the golden ears, so they got rid of him. That came out in cables, Podesta and Hillary Clinton cables. Yeah. So he went from being the number one country to the most destroyed, and now it's the largest open slave market in the world. Did anyone in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or CNN, did Anderson Cooper one night say, we're going to take you on a trip? Our correspondent just got back from Libya. We went all over the country. Here's what we found then. Let us now show you what Libya was a year before it was destroyed by NATO. Here's what it was before. The longest lived people in Africa, by the way. Longer lifespan than the average American by 3 years. Here's what Libya is today. Shouldn't someone be held accountable? So if we can't hold people who destroy nations and people accountable, if the liberal and conservative communities have in effect acted like Pontius Pilate and washed their hands of any of their leaders or supporters or followers' actions, then there is no way of dealing with the crimes against humanity that you've been talking about, that you were a victim of. So if you can't get your kid healthy, if our kids are graduating from school as illiterates in most schools, if our government is spending 56 cents out of every dollar in tax and taxes on the military-industrial complex, which it does not need, $1.3 trillion this year, more than the $700 billion, their offline units as well, holding a $6 trillion total debt for our invasions into Iraq and Afghanistan that we will never pay, 1,200% debt to gross domestic product. We are the most bankrupt country in the world. We thought Greece was a basket case at 287% debt to gross domestic product, and we put them on an austerity program, and yet we have $200 trillion in debt with only $19 trillion in assets or in income, and we are bankrupt. And yet we believe our economists are smart, and we follow their advice, and we consume. If we have kids that are now 1 in 36 boys will develop or end up with autism, yet we do not blame the vaccines, which are the only thing that's changed since 1988. And if we're incapable of dealing with medical errors, and right now medical errors, iatrogenesis is the number one cause of death and illness in the United States, more than cancer, heart disease, diabetes, or stroke It's medical problems, and yet there's not a single thing being done to change any of this. So if we can't change the basics, if we can't keep a kid from having obesity and diabetes and heart disease, if we have a shortening lifespan, if we can't help people get out of their debt, though we got rid of the debt, over $21 trillion in debt from Wall Street over that with quantitative easing and the big giveaways, if we can't help a person stay out of debtors' prisons, which were abolished in 1833, and we put them back in prison for a $40 bill on a debt that they can't pay on a traffic ticket, now they're paying $2,100 in a profit prison. Do you believe that we're capable then of making any fundamental changes in the more complicated and deeper body politic? Final question.
I don't. I hate to say that. I hate to offer no hope at all. But no, I have no hope at all. I don't think we can change. It's not in our nature to change. And you know, when you mentioned something earlier that's so important, and it's civil forfeiture. I've written extensively about civil forfeiture. It just seems to me to be one of the most clear-cut, black-and-white cases of right and wrong that exists in our government. And then you have attorney general after attorney general in both parties endorsing it and extending the program at the federal level. So if there's no one to protect us from our government, then what do we do? Where do we go from there? So I hate to be a downer. I really do. And I always prefer to offer a solution. But I don't have a solution. I'm so disgusted by our government. I just don't know what to do or what to suggest even. All I can think of is that we have to take third parties seriously, and we've got to really throw the bums out.
I agree with that, John. Let me add a few other thoughts and see if any of this is reasonable to you. I'm looking at the environment. On my last program last week, I gave a report of one of the most respected, if not the most respected, scientists involving one particular part of global warming and the ozone depletion. He was the one who rang the bell in the 1970s about this, and he made us conscious of it. And now he's saying, are you ready for this? We have 5 years left if we do not have a Marshall Plan to engage the entire world's resources to get off fossil fuels and to get off meat, and which is 18% in the United States cause of global warming because of methane, and try to deal with the reality. If we don't do it in 5 years, then all of our lives are going to change thereafter and in a very short period of time. The longest time I could find was 13 years if we don't make major changes. So that brought me to this. We're dealing with economic collapse, at least for those who are not benefiting from the capacity to earn money off money. And we are facing a health collapse, the global warming collapse. Now, these are all not going to be changed, and that's not being negative. And we have to stop thinking of something as I don't believe we should any longer talk about left and right, conservative and liberal. We should just simply talk about good and bad. Something is either good or it's bad in different measures and different degrees. So when you look at the places that things are happening bad, and it's not just one bad that's happening, it's multiple bads everywhere, then what is the solution? I believe that we do this. We start looking for other people of like minds and say, who can we get into a political position at the local level, state level, even federal level, who represents true progressive values? A progressive is someone who may have been a conservative, may have been liberal earlier in their career, came to see that identity was not only putting the straitjacket on yourself, but you couldn't move beyond the ism. So whatever the ism is of the party, that's as far as you could go. But with a progressive, you look for the truth wherever it is. And then you use the truth. And right now, the truth may be in a position where you have to become a vegan. Well, if you're a meat eater, you're going to reject it completely. You won't even consider the consequences. And so that's why we have to get out of being conservative and liberal and truly look at Where's the truth? So the truth is, change your diet. The truth is, start now while we have the time without emergencies. But if you lived in Baltimore yesterday and in Maryland, they had the worst flash floods in the city's histories.
Yes.
You saw cars going down the street. A person was swept away and killed. You see lava flows on the Big Island of Hawaii, and the 22 vents are open, and they haven't even seen the big burst yet when more vents open. We're not going to change these things. What we can do is get out of harm's way by looking at more sustainable places, better quality of life to live. Doing it alone is not the easiest thing. Doing it with other people where we share some common goals, where we maintain our identity, but are able to share in collective exchange. When you got out of prison, you didn't have any money, but you had your knowledge, you had your insight, you had that skill of being able to see something from a different perspective than you would have done earlier in your career. That's a value in an exchange. So the future is fair exchanges where people have a skill, a quality, an insight in sharing that. So when you have people making moves to more sustainable environments, getting off the grid, no longer shopping in their stores, watching their media, buying their products, buying things that are made in America or made with either union labor or made at fair exchange, meaning where someone was paid a living wage, eating food that's organic and locally grown and not GMO'd and trucked clear across America. If it means you don't have something, strawberries or blueberries part of the year, so be it. Being able to downsize your life so you're not living the American dream, which is part of their idea, because who benefits when you go into debt? They don't go into debt. You do. They benefit. Start to save instead of thinking that somehow our life is appreciably better when we are spending all the time. So when you get out of debt and you change where you're living to a more affordable place to live, and I think of all the people coming to New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles, and they can't afford to rent. Yeah. Well, then don't be there. Who says, where is it written that you have to live in a particular place? Live where you can afford to live. Be around people you enjoy being around. Eat food that's healthy for you. Pay attention to the power of a mind that is no longer as lazy as a sedentary body. You can have a sedentary mind. Bring back reading, bring back discussions, bring back Socrates' gardens where people who have something to say can share it with people who would like to hear it and apply that to their life. Look at how we can make communications with others around the world and care for them and give part of our time to helping others who are less advantaged than we are. So those are positive things that we can do that at least for those of us who are doing it will make a difference in our future. And as the average person continues on the Titanic, asking him to play a little faster tune, that's their business. John, we're not all going to make it into the lifeboats.
We're not. We're not going to make it into the lifeboats. But what we can do is work with like-minded people to build more lifeboats and make sure that people understand how to get to them.
Well said. John, thank you very much for being on. We look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you so much.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening today. And by the way, John's new book, and I recommend it highly, is Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. His website is johnkiriakou.com.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate.